Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
As you have no doubt heard already, USDA is forecasting record yields for corn and soybeans, making for record or near record production. The big question is, at this point,
is there anything that could stand in the way of these bumper Midwestern crops?
And the answer is?
Probably not.
Probably not. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey told us.
Number one, there's really no sign of any widespread severe thunderstorms anytime soon. And with each passing day, that gets crops closer to maturity. Furthermore, we continue to see the absolute absence of extreme heat.
And the presence of plenty of moisture in key growing areas. More rain coming this week.
And so, again, that gets us well into the second half of August with very few weather-related concerns.
Gary Crawford, Washington.
This is Agriculture Today.
So when we think about heat stress or cold stress, any environmental stressor, there's four key parameters that we really think about with heat stress.
Kansas State Beef Veterinarian A.J. Tarpoff.
Obviously, temperature and humidity. Everybody, when you wake up in the morning, check the news, you hear the forecast, and you'll get temperature. Okay. Well, temperature is only one piece of the pie. For how our animals really feel the environment around them, it's temperature, humidity, which we think about the humidity index, right? Sometimes we'll have some of those index scores that you'll hear on the radio or hear on the news. But with cattle, we take it a step further. The other two parameters that are missing in that heat index are wind speed and solar radiation. Okay. Those four parameters really make up on what the real feel. For, you know, if we really start thinking along lines of how cattle feel the environment, because they're very different from us. Where we're comfortable, cattle, you know, they might be uncomfortable, and vice versa. So when we really need to take into those four key parameters. And what's interesting is we actually have that in a model called an Animal Comfort Index, and that's available on the Kansas Mesonet website. So it uses those four parameters to give a real feel on how cattle are experiencing the environment.
How can you manage heat stress in pastures?
Obviously, animals out in the pasture, they have options, okay? They can find the wind currents in some of the hills on the pastures. They can seek out some of the shaded areas. They can go stand in a pond if need be. So typically, our animals out in the pasture, they don't have the same type of heat issues that we do in confinement. Remember I mentioned the pen floor can get to that type of temperature. You know, out in a pasture, they have more access to different currents, different breezes, and the dirt and the grass does not reach that elevated temperature that it would on a dirt lot. So again, we just try to provide added support for those animals. Shade occasionally, if there's not, you know, shaded areas or draws with trees and things like that in it, you know, they will seek out shade. You know, I've even seen cattle line up behind a telephone pole, just from the shade of a telephone pole. So sometimes providing some of that shade and some of that benefit, as long as we do give enough space for those animals so they don't bunch up. That would be the biggest thing with some of our pasture animals. But really, water. Making sure they have clean access, ready access to water. They can sustain and they can adapt and they can do very well out in those pasture settings with pretty minimal maintenance from us.
So when it comes to forage, Philip Lancaster, a Kansas State beef cattle nutritionist, says consider all alternatives.
I wouldn't say we should consider alternative feedstuffs at any time, because actually the hay is a very expensive feedstuff for producers. When we look at it on a cost per unit of nutrient basis. So on a cost per ton basis, it's usually cheaper than most other feedstuffs. But when we look at it on a cost per unit of nutrient basis, it becomes relatively expensive compared to other things like byproducts like distillers grains or soybean hulls or some of those. Cattle obviously need roughage. We can't go without roughage. So we've got to have some hay, but it may be more advantageous for you to purchase a somewhat lower quality hay if prices are very high. If there's a big gap between very high quality hay and say fair quality hay, and then supplement those cows with a byproduct feed like distillers grains or something like that to meet their nutrient needs. So, well, producers can work with their local extension livestock specialist and they can do some math to figure out, okay, if I buy a lower quality hay, how much distillers or soybean hulls or whatever would I have to feed to meet their nutrient needs? And is that more cost effective than buying the higher quality hay?
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The success that we've had, or any failure, but the success we've had is because you have four people that like each other. We know each other, nor our families, nor our backgrounds, and we really care about each other. And if you have a friend, no matter whether they have a D or an R by your name, you don't want to put your friend in a difficult position. You want to work it out with them. It's hard to say no to a friend.
West Virginia Independent Senator Joe Manchin.
Building relationships is extremely difficult. Every one of us knows that. And you have to put really, the country has to be before either our personal self or our politics. And once you're able to decipher who's there for that purpose, you're just like a magnet. You're drawn to them. You know who wants to be there and wants to do the right thing. So these are my friends, and I appreciate all the success that we've had, and I appreciate all the challenges. And still, I look at every challenge that basically we can still overcome them. The filibuster, I come from West Virginia, which is Bob Byrd territory. Bob Byrd pretty much wrote the rules of the Senate. And he told me, I've known him forever, and when I was governor, he said, now, Joe, he said, this Senate's the most unusual place. There's nothing like it in the world. There's nothing like us. We're so special. And he says, because basically, we can put the glue to it. We can put stability to something. So as hard as it might be to make something happen, to find agreement when with 60 votes right now, he says, it's that even harder to get rid of it. Mm-hmm. So the stability we have, the rest of the world looks for leadership and looks for stability. That's what gives it to it. But Kirsten and I were both amazed that our colleagues in the Democrat side left us. They were all being driven by, and we were both concerned about, can we do more for voting rights, protect voting rights, this and that. But that's pretty much a state issue. And we knew the courts with the checks and balances there, so we figured it would be worked out. But to throw away the filibuster to where really it made us say, okay, now, James and Bill, what do you think? What can we do to make this happen? Okay, that wouldn't be necessary. Who's ever in power, if you've got 50, plus if the president and vice president, that's 51, you can do what you want. If you think it's been dysfunctional with the House right now, what's going on in the House, we get rid of the filibuster, it'll be on steroids in the Senate. Mm-hmm. It'll be so dysfunctional. It'll destroy. And what happens there, you have no ability to say, well, we passed this piece of legislation, and I guarantee you, in 2 years, if the tide turns, it'll be repealed. Mm-hmm. That's what we're trying to prevent. So we've done a good job of that, I believe. And when you look at all the things we've done in a bipartisan way, you know, we, even if some of our Republican friends couldn't vote with us on sometimes we would differ, I'm still wanting their input. I want to know what. Tell me why. Tell me if I could have made it better. Tell me if I could have given you a reason. That's the conversations you have to have. But today, and I've said this out before, the political system's been weaponized. You know, we're expected, Kirsten and I, and the Democrat caucus, expected to be against James and Bill. If they're running for re-election, we're expected, whoever the Democrat finds to run against them, we're expected to write checks. It could be Donald Duck running against them. We're expected, if they got a D by their name, we've got to get rid of my friend. I'm saying, are you crazy?
I left the Democratic Party, just a reminder.
Sorry?
I left the party. Just want to remind everyone.
Yes.
Yes. Not a
yes.
Democrat.
But
yes.
The bottom line is, we have to, when you get to Washington, you have to pick a side. You know, you caucus here, you caucus there. To have committee assignments.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Using data from the USDA, today we're going to look at how U.S. milk supply has been evolving over the past two decades across the top 15 dairy producing states in the country.
Jared Hutchins is a University of Illinois ag economist.
In our dairy sector, there really are two different types of states, which I will call modern and traditional states, which are evolving in very different ways. As you can see from this map, the most obvious distinguishing factor in these types of states is geography. Modern dairy states are out west, and the traditional dairy states are in the Midwest and Northeast. Other distinguishing factors are history and how big their operations are. Traditional dairy states have a much longer history in dairy, hence the name traditional, and their herd sizes are usually less than 250 cows. In contrast, the modern dairy states are more recent entries into the sector, and their average herd size tends to be well over 1,000. In this presentation, the only real distinction I've drawn is whether the state has an average herd size below or above 500 head. I've chosen these 15 states because they are the top 15 states in terms of dairy cow numbers. For these states, I'm going to be breaking down both total production and average herd size in terms of its base components, which are milk yield, number of cows, and number of farms. The first observation we can make looking at total production is that traditional and modern dairy states are actually producing about the same amount of production and growth. However, they are doing it in very different ways. First, let's look at cow numbers. Traditional dairy states have barely added any cows since 2008, but modern dairy states added cows at a quick rate since 2000. After 2008, the rate of cow growth in modern dairy states has gone down and even started to slightly stagnate in the past 2 years. Now let's look at the other way to grow production, milk yield, measured in pounds of milk per cow. Dairy farms can grow yield by investing in better technology, adopting better management practices, and using genetics with higher milk yield. Modern dairy states have a higher milk yield than traditional dairy states, but starting in 2012, we're actually seeing traditional dairy states close this gap. If we normalize both trends to their 2010 level, we can see that milk yield in traditional dairy states has started to catch up in 2012. This is interesting because starting in 2010, we've also seen large improvements in dairy genetics thanks to the introduction of genomic testing. Finally, let's look at average herd size. Once again, I've normalized herd size to the 2003 level so we can compare the two regions on the same graph. Beginning in 2014, we see that average herd size has started growing faster in traditional dairy states. Since we know they are not adding cows, we know that herd size has to be driven by a decline in the number of dairy farms. In fact, from 2014 to 2020, the number of operations in traditional dairy states has gone down 37% compared to 26% in modern dairy states. So what's the future of U.S. dairy production look like? Well, one question we might ask is whether we are reaching a long-term stable number of dairy cows in the country. We've seen both production and cow numbers slightly stagnate in the last 2 years, but it remains to be seen if this will continue. Some issues that the dairy sector needs to confront are environmental regulation and zoning that may limit expansion, as well as worries about the resiliency of the supply chain. These kinds of factors may lead to these states deciding to no longer grow production by adding cows. If we've reached that long-term level, we may see modern dairy states start following the example of traditional dairy states and focus on growing yield to expand production instead of cow numbers.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, I think uncertainty was a good statement.
Tim Lust is CEO, National Sorghum Producers.
The reality is our farmers desperately need a new farm bill. That's the end game that we should accomplish before the end of this year. And just strongly encourage Congress to find a way to get that done. May have to be creative, may not be traditional. Before then, I think the other side of that just realistically is that we do have to probably pass a short-term extension here. Reality is if a farm bill doesn't get done, then unfortunately we're back into what is an economic assistance or what is a disaster package for 2023-24 look like, because things are tough on the farm, and Mother Nature has not been kind. Markets have not been kind. And so, think that it's unclear still exactly what happens in the next few weeks, but certainly we're focused short term on how we can get help there, and on longer term, how do we get a farm bill across the finish line.
While we move from farm bill to rice, Dr. Mark Jekinowski is chairman of USDA's World Ag Outlook Board.
More changes on the back year this year than on or this month than on the new crop year. So I mean, walk through those real quickly. Brazil rice production raised this month. That's just incorporating data from CONAB. Perhaps the extra flooding in Rio Grande do Sul wasn't quite as devastating as initially assumed. That production up a bit. Philippines, that's also some updated government data. And Vietnam, down in both the old crop year and the new crop year. That's mainly area driven, guided by information from post. Just a lower area there, some concerns about salinization, land and whatnot. So area declining in Vietnam. Global balance sheet, really small changes here, both in the old crop year and the new crop year. Not much of a story overall. 2023 crop year, a little bump up in trade. That's mainly Thailand there. New crop year, trade down a little bit. That's Vietnam, smaller crop there. Ending stocks down a bit as well. That's also driven by Vietnam. And consumption down a little bit overall too. That is lower consumption in Philippines, Vietnam, and Kenya. U.S. rice balance sheet, again, incorporating the information we got from NAS this morning. But first, starting on the old crop year, crop still being marketed right now. Raised our export forecast, 1.5 million hundredweight. That reflects some recent shipments of medium short grain that we're incorporating now into that forecast, mainly to North Asian markets. So, again, that's all medium short grain. Tightens up ending stocks a little bit on the old crop year. So that means a little bit tighter beginning stocks coming into the new crop year. Coupled with NASA's production change, yield reduction, mainly a lower yield in long grain, tightens up total supplies, and that is reflected directly in the ending stocks estimate, reducing ending stocks by the same amount as the reduction in total supply. No change in our price forecasts.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Two of the three people that were involved in the immigration, that border hole package, are sitting right here. Kirsten Sinema, myself, and Chris Murphy.
When Congress finally does something bipartisan, what happens? James Lankford from Oklahoma.
We spent an inordinately large amount of time together, the three of us, over almost 5 months, literally from the middle of October until February. We worked every single day on this except Thanksgiving Day, Christmas Day, and half of New Year's Day. Other than that, we literally worked on it every day. When we talk about trying to be able to move it, it's very technical, it's very challenging, but it's also extremely political. And as Bill was talking about before, any piece of this can have its own challenges. I would tell you, one of the things that I really understand even more on that is the biblical term of everything there is a season. Once we got past December and we started moving into January and February of this year, and the political primary season started rising up, people started turning their attention away from policy and more towards politics, and we lost our season. That was number one. Number two is we need to have as many people on board as we possibly can to be able to work through this. As you're working through something extremely challenging and difficult, you've got to have people that are committed to actually getting it done. We had a lot of people that were committed to it being done, but not doing it. So there's a big interest in saying this needs to get behind us as a country, but actually getting engaged to be able to solve it. Now, that's different, especially something as technical as this. And so for Kirsten and I, and with Chris Murphy working through all this, we were constantly looking for allies that wanted to not only see it was done, but to actually help us actually get it done. And that's still an ongoing challenge for us. So yesterday, we had about 5,800 people illegally crossing the border yesterday. We probably will again today. The problem still remains. So this is not going away. The problem still remains. And when it wasn't able to pass the Senate, I contacted leadership of the House and said, you guys put together a bipartisan package that can pass the House and send it to the Senate. And 2 months later, they said, yeah, we couldn't get it done.
Good example that compromise can be found. But Joe Manchin, senator from West Virginia, reminds us.
In 2013, we passed a bill, a total immigration overhaul bill, had 68 votes in the Senate, so it passed. Unbelievable piece of legislation, tremendous amount of border security, but also a pathway to legal immigration. And as a country, if we ever stop or prohibit illegal immigration, God help our country, we won't be the country we are. And you got to be careful of that. So when James is talking about, and what he and Kirsten did was tremendous. They worked and had a bill that we thought was a slam dunk. They've come to an agreement, let's do it. And on Sunday night, we had it. Monday night, it got questionable. Tuesday night, we lost it. Wednesday, the vote went down because of Donald Trump drumming into it at that time, made a statement. But John Boehner, a dear friend of mine, we passed a bill in 2013, and it went over to the House. And I called John Boehner, and he's been a dear friend. I said, John, just put it on the floor. It'll pass. I know it'll pass. He says, Joe, he says, I can't. Eric Cantor just got beat by a far-right Tea Party in Richmond, and they use it as amnesty, and says Eric Cantor was supporting amnesty, so it killed it. He was afraid, but he'll tell you today, one of the greatest opportunities he missed, when you say everything has its time, is by not putting that on, because we'd have been out of this system by now. We wouldn't have had this as a major concern.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The dairy industry has had a lot of economic issues that have pushed them to adopt some different reproductive technologies so that they can get full-blood replacement heifers out of their very best cows.
Oklahoma State Extension Beef Nutrition Specialist Paul Beck.
When we put these beef on dairy calves directly on feed at a very light body weight, we're seeing them be on feed for nearly a year, over 300 days, which gives them a lot of time to have some different digestive problems. We're seeing issues with liver abscesses. We are hoping that putting these cattle through a stocker phase on forage-based diets will shorten the time on feed and hopefully decrease some of those issues, just because they won't be in feed yards for as long a period of time. They'll be bigger, they'll be more mature, better able to handle the stresses that they see through the production phase. So we feel, you know, all the advantages of a stocker program in the beef industry should apply to these beef on dairy crosses. Dairy genetics within these cattle gives us some advantages in carcass quality, but they're very light muscled. The beef portion, or the beef sires, adds both muscularity, increased performance, increased gain, and increased efficiency to those dairy genetics. You know, we'll have a very good, high-quality product, and that beef cross just increases the efficiency and performance of those animals.
Oklahoma State grad research assistant Allie Grope.
So we are at the Marvin Clemmie Research Range out here in Bessie, Oklahoma, where I currently have some cattle on trial at. The research that I'm interested in right now and what we're doing out here is in the last few years, we've had this big increase in dairy beef calves entering the feedlot system, but there's been a little work in their post-weaning management. So right now out here, we have 150 head. 75 of them are dairy beef crossbred steers, and then 75 are just native straight beef cattle. We're seeing how they do on pasture and their gain, and then we're supplementing them with some DDG cubes, and we'll be getting them off here in a couple weeks and seeing how they do. And then alongside of them, we also have some calves up in Buffalo, Oklahoma at Buffalo Feeders that we will eventually be able to compare the two together, because those calves went straight 2 feet up in Buffalo, where these guys have been grazing the lovely grass that's out here. These dairy beef calves are performing about the same as the native beef calves, maybe just a little bit less. The beef calves are still going to outperform them in some aspects. But what we've seen is that these dairy beef crosses are really complementing that beef side and letting that dairy side behind, so that way they're doing better in the feedlot. I would say that they're pretty even, and I think that we'll get some really cool data from these guys running them alongside. I'll be interested once they go to slaughter their carcass data, but I think weight-wise right now they're looking really great and really similar to each other. So it would be a better management practice for these dairy calves. They'd have a better quality of life, better carcass data at the end, all of those things. And so it would also be a great opportunity for these stocker producers. And it's a great opportunity for dairy producers as well, because they're able to take those lower genetic females that they have that they still want a new lactation on but don't want to keep the calf for replacement females. And they can get these dairy beef crosses that they then can sell to a calf ranch, and the calf ranch can then take to stockers, and stockers can then take them to feedlots instead of feeding them like your traditional dairy calf.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Yield was raised by 1.2 bushels per acre, and harvested area was also increased by a million acres. So that adds up to a production increase of about 154 million bushels this month alone. So we're looking at a total production of just about 4.6 billion bushels, up about 425 million bushels year over year.
Talking soybeans, World Ag Outlook Board Chairman Mark Jackanowski.
And with that bigger crop, we anticipate that some of that's going to be exported given those larger supplies. So we raised our export forecast by 25 million bushels. And the bulk of the rest of it just ends up in ending stocks. So the ending stocks forecast was raised 125 million bushels. Now it is forecast at 560 million bushels, and that would be up 215 million year over year. Season average market price for soybeans, we lowered this month 30 cents per bushel. Now forecast at $10.80 per bushel.